You're listening to Generation AI
from LivePerson.
You're listening to Generation AI from LivePerson, the show where technology, business, and humanity meet. Whether it's innovations, solving today's problems, or the next big thing in AI, we're here to decipher the real-world ways that you can put it to work in your business. It's time to go beyond the tech specs to find the humanity that lies beneath. Let's get started.
Hello, Generation AI listeners. I'm your host, Joe Bradley, and I am totally psyched to bring Ranjita Bhattacharya onto the podcast today. Ranjita is a senior data scientist in the AI hub wing of the world's largest custodian bank, BNY Mellon. She has over 15 years of experience across roles including software development, solution designing, technical analyst, delivery manager, product manager, project manager, and more. And so I'm very excited to hear about how she ended up in her current role and what's got her excited about the future of AI and automation. Today, we're going to discuss everything from career paths for people interested in AI and data science, which is a particular topic of interest to me, and all the way to specific applications of AI in the financial sector, which, of course, is also inherently really interesting. So let's get started. Welcome to Generation AI, Ranjita.
Hi, thanks for having me, Joe. Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. Why don't we start from the beginning? I know you, like me, took a nonlinear path into data science. How did you get interested in data science and AI? And how did that start figuring into your career? Just like tell me the story of how you got here a little bit.
So I did my undergrad in computer science and engineering, and I just started working for a very big information technology firm. So in the initial years, I was a software developer. Then eventually, you know, as my career progressed, I moved into a different kind of roles. Like I performed the role of a solution designer. You know, I was a project manager. I was into delivery management and so on. So I performed a wide variety of roles. One project I specifically mentioned, I specifically remember during that period, like I was working for a data migration project. So essentially, as part of that, I had to, you know, move data from extremely opaque, archaic mainframe systems to a modern contemporary platform. And I was kind of appointed as the lead for that project. If I remember correctly, you know, that was the first time I actually started playing around with data, because as a software developer, you're kind of given specific requirements, right? You know, okay, from here, I'm going to pick the data. This is how the flow is going to be. And this is how my output is going to look like. But for a data migration projects, for the very first time, you know, I was introduced to concepts like linkage, you know, all totally disparate systems. You know, they are all in different formats. You don't know how to pull data from that. You don't know. It was a nightmare. It was totally a nightmare situation for me. But I ended up learning a lot of things. And I think indirectly, I was picking up a lot of skills at that time through the migration project. And finally, after working in the IT industry for almost 12 years, I decided to become a student. And, you know, I went back to school.
Wow. How did you do that? Where did you go? What kind of program was it?
Yeah, so I started, you know, so at that point of time, I used to go through a lot of articles, which will normally have this very colorful charts and bar graphs, you know, showing comparisons between certain data points. So it always attracted me. And especially, you know, because I performed so many different kind of roles in the IT industry, I really like, you know, digging into data and digging into the intricacies in particular. So I think I was more of an analyst than a software developer, although I started my career as a software developer, but eventually, you know, I moved on to the role of an analyst. And then, you know, I was bored of my job, and there were, you know, certain other reasons because of which I kind of, you know, planned for my master's degree. I was working in India at that point of time. So I applied here to a couple of universities as an international student. And that's how I joined Rutgers University, New Brunswick. So I enrolled in a full-time master's program, master's in data science for 2 years. And I picked up a lot of skills. I was just overjoyed to go get back to school. Like many people told me that, are you sure you want to go back to school after, you know, being a professional, you know? Are you sure you want to go back to school? I said that, yes, I'm sure I want to go back to school. It was great. I mean, the experience was great. It was better than I imagined. I picked up so many skills. I did lots of projects. And finally, I graduated in the COVID year. And my journey as a full-time data science professional start. So, yeah.
That's so fascinating. It's interesting to me. I want to hear a little bit more about what your first job was too, if that's all right. But before we do, it's so interesting to me. I'm like tracking this all and like mapping it to my own past as well. And I feel like you and I kind of came almost from opposite directions, right? For me, it was the math and the data that started it. And then the technology and the engineering pieces came, you know, as a consequence of that. And for you, you sort of came into it the other way around. It's like you started in the engineering, like, oh, I really have this passion for data. And how cool is it that you got excited about a data migration project that spurred this all off? Like, you can't fake love like that. You know, if you're going to love a data migration project, you do love data, like, well done. But I think it speaks to the variety of skills that are needed to make this job work. And it's almost like the more you can grab, the more types of skills you can put into your toolbox, so to speak, the more successful you can become. Have you experienced that as well?
Absolutely. So I think, data science is a very domain agnostic discipline, to be very honest. Anybody can actually be a data scientist. And I literally mean that. Any person coming from any background previously, you know, can be a data scientist, but it needs some work, definitely.
Yeah. Say more about that. Like, why is that an important concept for you? And why do you feel it's particularly relevant for data science? I kind of agree, but I'm curious about your, you know, what's behind that statement for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, if you look at the use cases, you know, you actually need to think out of the box. Okay, definitely, you know, you need to have the technical skills. That is something all of us, we have to pick it up. So in that case, probably, you know, if you're coming from engineering background, you have some advantage. Like, you know, if I talk about, because, you know, you're used to programming, you're used to, you know, kind of designing flows and all that. But those skills are not difficult to pick up. I mean, especially nowadays with the amount of, you know, free courses, excellent, like free courses, which are like, really of great quality, you know. So it is totally, you know, at our fingertips, and anybody who wants to go and really has the passion to go for it has all the resources available, that's for sure. But you, to solve a data science use case, it's very different from you cannot equate a data science problem with a software engineering problem. Okay, that's the first thing. I know many people, they tend to do that. They, you know, they think that they're kind of overlapping and they're the same thing, but they are definitely not the same thing. So in my experience, I have worked with people, you know, coming from different backgrounds, you know, people coming from, say, you know, economists, physicists, chemists, you know, all of who transitioned into the role of a data scientist. So the use cases on which I worked upon, I definitely feel their inputs were vital. Their inputs, they kind of, you know, totally, they were like pivotal as far as the success of the, you know, use case was concerned, because many a times you just end up writing a bunch of code and the output means nothing. The stakeholders, they cannot make any sense of it. Nobody understands what is the larger problem we are trying to solve. So definitely, you know, in that case, I think anybody can become a data scientist. I think the skill, which is an absolute must for any person who wants to be a good data scientist, is communication. I think communication is the key.
I think you're right. I think it's almost hard to overstate the value of communication in many roles. Like, it does kind of, you know, it does end up at the top of the pyramid, I think, in a business context, you know, for people generally as a skill that if you have it, it's a very important meta skill in a lot of ways too. If you have it, you are going to be very likely going to create value, particularly if you can mix it with some, you know, some specialist and subject matter expertise, as you describe. And I think your other point around the kind of, I don't know if you said it this way, but what I took from it was needing to see a problem holistically. And really, to be successful at data science, you're not like domain bound in the sense of like, this is the kind of problem that I solve. This is the way I solve it. And if it fits on that assembly line, then I will help you. And if not, I won't. You sort of don't have that luxury. Or if you're, you know, depending on how you look at it, like, you don't have to be constrained in that way. And I would agree that the successful scientists and data scientist folks that I see, whatever background they come from, they share that passion for like, what's the real problem here that needs to be solved? You know, they like to kind of back up to that at first. So let's talk about your current role a little bit. You're at BNY Mellon and you're part of the AI Hub and you've got this focus there on metrics and analytics, it sounds like. Can you just tell us more about the role and what it's like doing AI and data science in a big bank like that? And I think our listeners would be really curious to hear, you know, about that job in these ways.
So BNY Mellon is the world's largest custodian bank, and it is 240 years old. So this is, we are celebrating our 240th year, which is something I definitely want to share with the listeners, because that is not something you will hear. It's not a very common thing, you know, you'll hear about other companies.
I mean, that's only like a few years younger than the United States of America, right? That's pretty impressive.
Actually, that's pretty impressive. Exactly. So it is a big bank, but it's a traditional bank. So AI Hub is a team of AI professionals. And this whole team was set up with the idea of transforming the bank. It was set up with the idea of kind of giving, you know, totally a new definition to the bank's role in leveraging the AIML systems. And our team has like professionals, all kinds of professionals. So it's not just the data scientists, but we have data engineers, we have subject matter experts, product leads, governance people. And we also have tie-ups with a lot of universities, you know, so we are constantly learning and trying to keep ourselves updated with the, you know, the explosive pace in which this field is growing. And it's a team of, you know, professionals having, you know, diverse skills. So currently I am a senior data scientist. I mostly work with different line of businesses. So because our AI Hub is kind of, it's a generic team. It's not tied to a particular line of business, but typically for a bank, you know, we have like different, when I say line of businesses, I mean different wings like investment management or markets or, you know, the legal team, everything, you know, it covers a wide range of teams. So I primarily work with a different line of businesses. So usually, you know, we have subject matter experts who will identify the pain points and where AIML can contribute most effectively in creating, you know, a big impact for the bank. So typically, you know, we have those use cases defined in the very beginning of maybe the beginning of the financial year, or I don't know, maybe in mid-year, whenever, you know, we are making that plan. And together with the SMEs and product leads, we go, we interact with all the line of businesses. We try to, you know, understand their pain points. We start with data gathering the data. And many a times, you know, it's absolutely important to educate the stakeholders, like, you know, what value or what benefit, whatever use case we are working on is going to bring to their wing. And sometimes there is a significant level of skepticism involved that, you know, it's going to, because there is real money involved, right? So all those things. So that's why I said that communication is vital, especially if you're working for, you know, such a big traditional bank where you have like real people who have worked in sitting behind the trading desk for like two decades who can just shut me down in a second if I try to explain something, you know, if I try to explain then how a particular model can improve the prediction, whatever they're doing based on their SME knowledge. So all those things. It's very interesting. So it's a new initiative. There are a lot of challenges. It's highly dynamic. It's extremely volatile, but there's a lot of learning involved. Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting. Like I had a similar experience, you know, working, you know, particularly at Nike, which was very much like trying to and succeeding in bringing data science into its ecosystem or into its, you know, its world, but similar, you know, interactions at times. And it's almost like a Moneyball problem that you're after there, where it's like you got people that have been doing work successfully for a long time. And it's definitely possible that that gets set up as a conflict-oriented dynamic with new mathematical ways to solve problems or to augment, you know, solutions to problems. I think that's an important problem that data scientists often encounter. Do you have ways or examples or thoughts about, you know, good ways to resolve those problems? Like, what do you do when you feel like you might be in a situation like that? Or how do you avoid ending up in a situation like that?
Yeah, so it's difficult to avoid ending up in a situation like that. But most of the time, so normally what I personally prefer to, you know, keep them in the communication loop all the time. So for example, you know, I come up with the first iteration of the model, whatever we are thinking, just a baseline model, and I share the results with them. So typically, you know, we'll always ask for their feedback. Like, what do you think about it? You know, is it good, how good or bad it is? So that way, slowly, you know, it kind of gives them confidence also, because we always tell them that there is no like one size fits all solution. We are going to continuously, we'll keep on iterating on it. And we'll only put it in production whenever you are comfortable with the numbers. And we have an established process where, you know, we like every day, you know, we kind of send them reports. For example, if, you know, there's a model which generates some kind of prediction every single day, then typically, you know, those reports will be shared with them in a very readable format, probably, you know, put them in a nice dashboard so that they don't have to wander around a lot. They can just quickly go, just eyeball them and, you know, kind of get an idea about how good or bad the model is performing. But however, having said that, this is not enough because, you know, as I said, you're interacting with people from different backgrounds. You know, they have their own temperament, and especially in a big traditional bank, sometimes they lose it. Some people are very friendly. They are ready to work with you, but it's not the same for others. So you just have to suck it up sometimes, you know?
Well, and the mantra of communication, communication, communication is a pretty good one to start with, you know? And I think the other paradigm people often talk about is, you know, building helpers for the people rather than building replacements for the people can really help too. You mentioned, I think, and if I misheard you, I apologize, but I thought you mentioned some academic collaborations at BNY Mellon. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
How do you guys structure that? That's like, people do that really differently. I'm curious about how at BNY you run that.
So we have collaborations with NYU and CMU, you know, all these major universities which are in this region. So typically, you know, we hire interns from these universities. So they'll come and they'll, you know, work on some use cases in which we feel that we need their inputs. Apart from that, you know, our team, there is also an active push for publishing papers in major conferences. And when obviously, you know, not everybody is a researcher here, so some amount of help is definitely needed. You know, if you know what you want to write, but, you know, just to put it in a proper format and everything, you kind of collaborate. So that is where the university collaboration is like, really, it's very useful. And then, you know, there's a lot of things going on in the academic field also, right? So sometimes, you know, they are sharing all those updates with us. And we also try to see, you know, if we can leverage that and use it in the current solutions. However, I think I just have, as far as my experience goes, I feel industry and academics, there is still a long way to go. There is a long gap.
Yeah, I would agree.
So before it can be bridged, yes, we are working towards it, but still there is a gap, definitely, in the way researchers think and in the way a typical corporate company works. So
yeah, I would say that's 100% true. Some version of that is healthy because you want the institutions, like the institutions are aimed at different things and you want that diversity of approach. But then some of it is like the gulf is really, really broad. And I think we saw a lot of this in, you know, earlier foundation model research. Well, I guess I should say in general NLP research for a long time, the benchmarks, I think this has changed a bit now with foundation models, but the benchmarks for quality of models and things like that were very, like the academic benchmarks were kind of very narrow and didn't always help you use any of these systems in like a real world capacity.
And many times if you're reporting on like 10 different metrics, I mean, the stakeholders, they cannot even make any sense of it. You know, what does it mean? What am I getting out of it? So you really have to simplify it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think you have to have the right measures too. You have to make sure that your measures are true to the real problem in real life. And that's not always the same as the abstract problems. But yeah, you also, on the other side, right, you can't overwhelm people with information. They may not know what precision and recall mean.
I know. For me also, it took me some time to like, you know, understand what precision and recall is. I used to get confused all the time when I was initially learning those things. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a funny one. It's a funny one because it comes out of the old information retrieval worlds. And the nomenclature makes sense there, but it doesn't make sense the same kind of intuitive way with other applications. Anyway, we could go down this road forever, but I wanted to not forget to ask you this question. So we care about customer engagement a lot at LivePerson, right? That's our business, is to help brands engage their customers better and to use AI to do it. How do you see customer engagement changing with, you know, because of or due to AI and data science in the financial sector? Do you have an opinion on that?
Yes, definitely. Customer engagement there's a huge potential, you know, as far as finance is concerned. Although I would like to state something here that finance is a different world, you know, if you compare to other industries, because there are a lot of guardrails in place. A lot of governance is also in place. So you just cannot go and just come up with a model.
You guys have a bit of a healthcare problem there, right? You have kind of a similar problem to them. Yeah,
exactly. Yes, you're right. It's kind of, you know, it's very similar to the healthcare also has the same issues. However, you know, definitely, you know, now there a path is being formed now. So not everything is like, you know, instantly put into production. And we are continuously in the mode of constant proof of concept iterations. You know, that is something which is kind of a easier way to deal with it. So definitely, you know, as far as finance is concerned, I think some of the high-level use cases in which AIML can greatly, you know, AIML can have a huge impact in the finance world is tackling customer attrition, okay? So customer attrition is a huge problem, I think, for all the banks, especially for a custodian bank, because it means, you know, if losing an account means you're actually losing a lot of money, okay? And because it's hard to acquire customers also. So yes, that is one part. Secondly, in fraud detection, which is like one of the, you know, burning issues, and the whole landscape of fraud, it's constantly evolving. So every single day you'll see something new. So technically, you know, you cannot even run a model for probably a month. It'll fail to catch some of the cases. So that is how difficult the problem is. But definitely, you know, if you're trying, you know, different approaches and you kind of, you know, take the best of everything and try to come up with a, you know, try to summarize the outcome of what 10 different approaches is telling you, it is definitely working. In my experience, it is working as far as fraud detection is concerned.
Yeah. Do you see in either of those areas or any other areas you want to talk about, do you see major changes coming with the large language models or foundation models in general? Like how does that kind of feather in for you into some of these disciplines?
Yes. So as far as fraud is concerned, see, large language models, it's a game changer. I don't know. I mean, technically, it is under the realm of AIML, but it's just, it has become a, you know, big elephant in its own. That's it. That's how it is turning out to be. So definitely, you know, large language models. So I am working on a few use cases where we are trying to find some patterns. I will not like to get into the details, but yes, definitely it's being used extensively right now. And there's an active push actually to find out use cases which where we can use the LLMs more effectively. So definitely, I think it's not just finance, but it is going to be used everywhere. So yeah, definitely for finance. I'm not sure. I don't have an experience of using LLMs for fraud detection. I mean, personally, I don't have an experience, but I'm sure, you know, there are a lot of teams working on it. I'm 100% sure that as far as identifying fraudulent patterns is concerned, large language models can definitely contribute in that.
Makes sense. I mean, they are big sequence readers and writers in the end of the day of multivariate inputs and outputs. So there you go.
Yeah. Because, you know, many a times, like for fraudulent transactions, you just have some free text field where, you know, they're just going to scribble something. And there are actually patterns. Maybe people are scribbling at a haste, the fraudsters, whoever is trying to push that transaction through. But you won't believe it. There are still patterns. Okay. So which you won't be able to catch everything, but there are patterns typical to a particular client, which keeps, you know, coming over again and again. So definitely, we have been doing it programmatically all this while. Now with large language models, I'm sure that process is going to get simplified.
Yeah, I still think there's just a whole swath of applications. Like the chat application is so interesting to everyone because we do it with each other. We're programmed to do it, so to speak. But then the models as more general understanders or utilities around other kinds of sequences, I feel like is one of these areas that's like just going to open up soon, as you know, the extent to which we can get the right data. And DNA is another example that like I think is really interesting potentially.
Absolutely.
So I guess what I'd love to do now is transition over to our new segment for this season, which is Hype It or Hate It. Ranjita, are you ready for Hype It or Hate It? Do you know what you're getting into here?
Yeah.
Good. All right. So for our listeners, each of us is going to have 60 seconds and we will pick either a hype or a hate. And we will sort of go off on our hype or hate for the 60 seconds. And then the other will have a chance to respond to that hype or hate. And we've got Britt on the line to keep us honest about the time.
Excellent. So, Joe, you already know the deal here. I'm going to put 60 seconds on the clock. There's going to be a little buzzer that will go off. In between, I'm going to alert you at 30 seconds, at 10 seconds, and then, of course, the buzzer is going to go off. Do either of you have any questions before we start?
Nope.
No.
All right. Let's get to it. All right, Joe, your time starts now.
Okay. Since we're on this subject, Ranjita, with like, that's a little bit academic, I'm going to go academic today. I have a hate. It's a hate and a hype. So I love the empiricism in the literature, in the academic literature today. I love how people are investigating these new models. I love how much we're learning about how these model architectures behave. I think all that's great. But I think we're missing a key component to the academic literature today, which is more about the foundational mathematics.
30 seconds.
Understanding what is really going on in terms of the math, the linear algebra, the Hilbert spaces, all the functional mathematics behind these big models. I don't think we have a good theory of them. And I don't think there's even worse than that.
10 seconds.
I don't think there's a good mechanism to publish papers about that. And so the whole system like has kind of lost an ability for us to learn more and to grow in terms of our fundamental understanding of the mathematics of these systems. And I think that's to our detriment.
Time is up, Joe. Well done. That's right in time. Ranjita, do you want to weigh in on what Joe had to say today?
Great. I don't believe that he was not prepared. I mean, it just came out instantly.
What do you think? Do you think I'm off base?
Ranting is more fun, right?
But what do you think? Do you agree or disagree with the tenant there? Do you think the...
Yeah. I agree. I totally agree. Absolutely.
All right. Perfect. Ranjita, you are up next. Same rules apply. I'm going to set the clock for 60 seconds. I'll notify you at 30 and then again at 10. You'll either hear the buzzer or you'll hear me just say time's up. Are you ready?
Yep.
All right. Here you go. Your hype it or hate it starts now.
Okay. So today I'm going to rant about the elephant in the room, which is the large language models. The Swiss Army knives of the digital age. But let's talk about, you know, for large language models, with great power comes great responsibility. But are we really using it right? There are ethical concerns. Massive data guzzlers. The carbon footprint is through the roof. Okay. The environmental impact of training these behemoths is just unimaginable. All the copyrighted data it is guzzling, the privacy concerns are just gone. Nobody knows.
30 seconds.
The ethical issues, and how can we forget about the hallucinations? You ask the model something, the model confidently responds something totally different. And every single day a new LLM is releasing. We don't know what's going to happen to the jobs. And I'm really very scared. I'm extremely concerned about my own job also.
10 seconds.
And yeah, sometimes I just keep asking this question myself. Did I really need it?
Time's up. Well done. All right, Joe, weigh in. What do you think about what Ranjita had to say?
I think you're bringing up really good points. I think to me, there's a kind of like there's kind of an Uber effect here going on where it's like Uber wasn't really legal from a regulations and taxi perspective. And then it just got to be such a big thing that it stopped mattering that it wasn't really legal. And I feel like we're in kind of the same boat with LLMs in some way, and not that they should be legal. I don't mean anything like that, but there are these issues, but the utility is so strong that it kind of stopped mattering to everybody. And I wouldn't mean to say we should slow down or stop development or something like that, but I think it's another piece to this puzzle of like, are we studying all the right things? Is there enough room in the world and in the academics and in the institutions that we have to make sure that we're investigating all the problems that need to be investigated around these models, whether it's foundational mathematics, whether it's the ethics and the bias, which I think is getting some press, but could use more, you know, or whether it's the models themselves. So yeah, I think great point. I guess that brings us to the end of our session for today. Ranjita, it was a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I had a great time.
All right. And thank you all out there for tuning in to Generation AI. We'll see you next time and hope you have a wonderful rest of your day, wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
You've been listening to Generation AI.
Automating better business.
A show from LivePerson.
Never miss an episode by subscribing to the show in your favorite podcast player. Please give us a rating, leave a comment, and share the episodes you love. Until next time.